You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim. Happy Halloween.
What are you dressing up as?
Someone doing leaves in the yard.
A landscaper. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Taking a look at this most valuable stock here, how valuable is NVIDIA and is it really worth it?
Yeah, so the point I think is, yes, it's been a company that's had huge sales growth, been very much at the forefront of the chip making for this AI explosion that's happened in the past couple of years. And the differentiation between leading companies and their shares as investment is something that has to be made. Very often people make the assumption that, you know, if it's a good company, it's a good investment. And the distinction that I always try and make is that what makes a good investment is how much you get it in terms of price relative to value. So if you're underpaying for a future stream of cash flow, it's going to be likely a rewarding undertaking and worth any capital risk that you take on for it. But if you're overpaying for that stream of cash flows, then you're likely to find that even if it's a great company and even if it persists for, you know, decades to come, that you indeed may lose money on that investment. So when it comes to something like NVIDIA, I was writing this week that it reminds me of this whole AI mania has really inflated the price of certain things to such a degree that it makes no investment sense whatsoever. And the example with NVIDIA being that the market capitalization of the company, you know, about $3.5 trillion is just obscene. Like it's more than the entire Canadian stock market. It's more than the entire UK, France, Germany, and Italian stock markets in terms of the market price of that one company is now priced more than all of the companies in those countries. So that just gives you some term of reference to say, you know, that seems extremely optimistic. And the overall weighting of a company like NVIDIA has now become more than 7% of the S&P 500 itself. So again, back to this point about the tech explosion that's happened. You know, I lived through this in the late 1990s into the 2000 peak when tech was considered to be, you know, the most brilliant thing ever to happen to humanity and how it could never be anything but a fantastic investment. And of course, that euphoria drove the price of shares up an exponential amount. And yes, they were looking extremely lucrative in terms of something that people were holding for a period of time there, but they became way overdone. And indeed, that's what's happened with the tech sector now, where the top six companies, Apple, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, and Alphabet, make up, you know, nearly a third of that index. So all the people that, you know, the other thing that's happened in the past few years is this real overwhelming usage of passive flows into indexes. And the S&P 500 has been attracting fund flows from all over the world because of this tech AI, you know, euphoria that's gone on in this space. And so the price of those shares has become so extremely elevated and such a huge chunk of the whole basket and such a huge benefactor of cash flows from all over the world relative to other stock markets and other sectors. And what happens is when it gets to be that overweight, it's very often a very bad investment for years after that. And I give you the example of 2000 where the tech sector, actually it's more extremely valued now than it even was at the 2000 peak in many important metrics. But then the tech shares fell by 80% and didn't recover for 15 years. So those companies, many of them continued and are around today, you know, are still did well and you know, grew market share, et cetera. But the actual investment in them was a catastrophic disaster for the people that bought when the valuations made no sense. And so that's why, you know, I call it value indiscriminate flows. They've been, you know, internationally going into this one handful of stocks, and it has disproportionately elevated the S&P and the NASDAQ, the U.S. stock market, relative to the rest of the world. Again, historically, when we see that kind of extreme weight overvaluation in that one market, it ends up being a sign that it will then underperform for years after that. So there's that, and then there's the contagion that's happened. You know, in some ways, when you get that kind of stock market euphoria, it infects other markets, even if they don't do it to the same degree or rise to the same valuations. And that's also happened. You know, we've seen the Canadian stock market rebound since last October. And it's really important to keep in mind, Jim, that a year ago, last October, the major stock markets had gone nowhere for 2 years. They were basically at the same level as they had been at the peak in 2001, which was also a manic peak when people were just flooding whatever into, you know, tech in particular and U.S. stocks and any kind of financial asset. They were just throwing money at it back when interest rates were virtually nothing, right? But fast forward to today, and interest rates have actually risen significantly. Real interest rates are quite rewarding now for things like deposit, safer, you know, instruments, treasuries, this kind of thing. And people have still been throwing money without any mathematical connection into really overinflated assets, all on the idea that it doesn't matter what you pay, that it's going to go up. And so that's really just the hallmark of financial manias, bubbles, that ultimately end up being disastrous. Another example is the S&P 500 right now is trading at 3x sales. The basket itself at the peak in the 2000 cycle, which heretofore was considered absolutely, you know, a crazy, crazy time of wild abandon, it was trading at about 2.5x its sales. So today, it's even worse than that, right? And so, you know, the price to sales of just a company like NVIDIA, you know, it's trading about 36x expected sales for the future and about 64x its expected earnings. The even if you smooth out this period over a 10-year window, that's what the Shiller PE, the CAPE, they call it, and it is trading at 35x expected earnings on a CAPE smooth basis. Again, above where it was in past peaks, and we're talking about the only ones in the category are 1929 and 2000, way worse than 2007 as a cycle peak. So all of that to say that there's a lot of capital risk in equities, in credit. Again, the spreads, you know, the amount of compensation you're being paid to take on corporate debt at this point. I've explained many times that corporate debt trades with the equity cycle. So corporate bond prices tend to inflate as indiscriminate capital just throws itself at whatever. And so when it does that, when it drives up the price of those credit instruments, the yields they're paying drops. So right now you're getting less than 300 basis points of yield for a corporate credit, high-yield debt, which is a high risk, you know, a decent chance they're going to default or have to restructure. 42% of the basket of Russell 2000 companies, for example, is negative earning at this point. That's also a record. So, you know, here we have interest rates still decently high, companies having to refinance into this environment. They were already earning negative earnings coming into it, and you've got this euphoric pricing of the future from a lot of corporate assets. And all that is usually a recipe for very subpar investment returns going forward.
Is household wealth at extreme risk because of things like this?
Well, this is the thing, right? So all of what I've just described, being that we haven't seen anything this expensive in, you know, 24 years, and before that, not since 1929, at the same time, that euphoria has infected the investing public. It's always the case that they come to the cycle, you know, very late, because they tend to buy high, sell low, and then steer clear when valuations are the most attractive because they're sort of licking their wounds and trying to rebuild their balance sheets after they're harmed. So they did that in 2021. Many of them, you know, were piling in with wild abandon. Then stocks, as I say, dropped for a couple of years, and a lot of people suffered losses. Many people sold then at the bottom, which they're very wont to do, and then haven't come back until in the last, you know, few months. They've really sort of been piling back in again. So what we've seen is that the fund flows have been, you know, the household balance sheet is now heavily weighted to equities, the most since, again, since we saw at prior cycles, like 21 and 2000 before that. And again, that just gives you more indication of the fact that people have not, it's not a function of like they win the lottery and they say, oh, I better cash out this ticket so I can get my cash. When they win the lottery in the sense of they're in this period of wild inflation and prices go up a lot more than historically normal, very few people then think, oh, I should cash some of this out, or I should sell and reallocate, or I should reweight. They haven't been doing any of that. They've been seeing it as, you know, I'm winning, so I'll keep winning. And I always point out that if you were going to the casino and you'd been, you know, hitting the slots and been getting great, great luck and winning, a rational mind says, you know, oh, wow, I've won for the last hour. I should probably take my money and leave. But no, the irrational mind of euphoric investors thinks, oh, good, I should buy more of this, or I should pile even more of my net worth into that. So you have record low cash, very little in the terms of treasury bonds, next to no one's holding that, and everyone's piling into the riskiest stuff. So again, very perfectly wrong timing is very common.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, has the Bank of Canada cut interest rates too much too soon?
I would like to back up, Jim, and say that what they did wrong was leaving interest rates at zero for far too long, you know, leaving them for a decade where allowing the prime rates or the banking rates in the country to be less than the cost of living, which meant that there were basically negative real rates, and that encouraged an incredible amount of borrowing and an incredible amount of leverage in our housing market, which drove prices to a point where they're unaffordable. And now, you know, we knew they couldn't leave interest rates at zero forever, but in fact, if you remember, the Bank of Canada actually said something along the lines, you know, when rates were at all-time lows, when people were taking out mortgages for 1.5%, you know, back during the pandemic, the Bank of Canada was saying things like, don't worry, we won't be raising rates for a really long time. And of course, then they proceeded to start raising rates in 2023 and leave them at the highest since 2007. So, you know, now not surprisingly, the economy is really showing the slowing effects of much higher interest rates. Real rates, you know, here's the other thing, that even though the Bank of Canada started cutting interest rates and has done, you know, a 25 and 250 cuts in the last meetings, what happens is that the treasury market initially, and this is very common, when the central banks start cutting, the treasury market initially sells off because there's this kind of belief that, oh, central banks are going to make money easy again. We're going to see a big resurgence in spending and inflation. And so the bond market tends to sell off. Well, what happens in that initial reaction is that the treasury market actually sets the commercial loan rates in the economy, right? So here you've got the central banks cutting, and the U.S. Fed on September 18th cut by a 50 basis point response. And what happened is that treasury yields have actually risen in the 6 weeks since then. And what that means is that mortgage rates have risen, Jim. The borrowing costs have risen while central banks are trying to ease financial conditions. So you've had this easing for publicly traded companies because equity prices and their bonds have all risen, which means their finance costs have dropped for the, you know, the publicly traded side of the economy. But for the bulk of the economy, the households and the you know, small businesses and people that borrow through the banking system, they've actually seen an increase in their financing costs. So mortgages coming up for new, for renewal right now, you know, in Canada, they're facing rates, you know, about around 4.5 again. Now you may say, well, that doesn't seem very low. Well, I'm sorry, very high, but it is relative to the people who got mortgages for less than 2% 4 and 5 years ago, right? And so those terms are coming up for renewal. In the United States, it's been an even greater overshoot since the Fed cut on September 18th, and now you're seeing that their 30-year mortgage rates are well above 7% again. Well, not surprisingly, you see a big sell-off, a big downturn in respect of transactions, sales in the financials, in the real estate sector. So we've seen people listing are starting to panic. The ones who thought it would all be solved by, you know, once the central banks start cutting rates, it'll all be solved, they were waiting to list properties. Now they're starting to panic and say, oh my gosh, you know, I really don't want to carry this with these escalating costs in insurance and property taxes and mortgage rates. And we've got the weakest actual demand on the sales side that we've seen in many decades as you have the inventories spiking. So to answer your question, I'm not surprised that the Bank of Canada is sort of panicking when it looks at, for example, you know, Q3 GDP growth that's looking about 1% when they had forecast themselves it would be about 1.5% in Canada, and we're now seeing, you know, maybe 1%. The economy is definitely slowing. Our unemployment rate has definitely risen. You know, major economists are saying that if the unemployment rate continues to tick up, that's going to be a big problem for a highly levered household sector. So all of that to say that they are very likely to cut further. It's presently a coin toss whether they go another 50 beeps in December at their meeting. Of course, the U.S. Central Bank, there's some controversy over what they'll do depending on how the election goes, right? Next week, whether we get an actual outcome of the election or whether it ends up being like a 2000-style disaster where there's no clear answer and it has to go to the Supreme Court, or, you know, depending on how tight things are, you could have a massive period of extension of uncertainty around this. You've already got a highly over-levered, over-valued financial sector. So this is like, you know, driving 200 miles on an icy lake, right? You might get away with it, but there's a very high chance of a wipeout because nothing's going to go exactly perfect and you've priced everything for perfection. So all to say that I think that the Canadian Central Bank is certainly on a cutting mode as it watches the economy weaken and the housing sector weaken and the unemployment rise. It's going to take a while for that to filter through to the mortgage market. On these past backups, first of all, whenever they've cut 50 basis points in the past, it has only been 3 times that they've done in increments larger than 25, and those 3 times were major financial dislocations. So we're talking about the 2001, you know, 9/11 downturn. We're talking about the 2008 financial crisis. We're talking about the pandemic. Those were the last times that we saw the central banks go 50 beeps. And it wasn't a good sign, right? It was a sign of, holy cow, something's really going wrong in the financial sector. So when you see them do these 50 back-to-back 50 basis point cuts, you have to think, geez, what are they looking at? You know, why are they so concerned? Again, relative to a stock market that's trading at all-time highs, you know, what's going on here? Why is the data seemingly at odds with what the stock market is seeing? And I think the answer is the stock market is not looking. It's seeing euphoria. It has the expectation of, you know, happy days will always be here, and you've got, as I say, the real economy really starting to struggle. So the good news, I guess, is that mortgage rates typically bottom 2 to 5 years after central banks start cutting interest rates. So if that's the case, they're going extra fast this time. So you could see mortgage rates ultimately, you know, they typically start to follow lower again after that initial spike when, you know, people think, oh, they're going to revive inflation. It's harder to do than that. It takes longer, and they'd have to do probably some pretty significant fiscal handouts to try and revive consumption at this point. But basically, it's usually short-lived that the Treasury yields back up, and then the Treasury market starts to rally again, which brings these borrowing rates finally down and ultimately bottom a couple of years after the central banks have been cutting. So I think longer term, you're going to see, you know, interest rates come down on commercial loans in the banking system, certainly over the next year or two. So that may help some people that have loans coming up for renewal a year or two from now. But it remains to be seen whether they go, you know, back towards the zero bound or whether, in fact, they stop with the Bank of Canada or the U.S. Fed rate, you know, around two or above. And let's hope they do, because we've learned from the zero interest rate policy era that it was absolutely disastrous in terms of what you got was a lot of debt and a lot of bad allocations of capital and not a lot of productivity out of that, a lot of wasted money, right? So hopefully they've learned from that experience and said we're not, you know, and decide not to go back below, say, 2% on the overnight rate. And so it's going to be a fiscal discipline for people who are used to money that was free. But ultimately, if we just take that hit and recalibrate our behaviors and allow prices to come back down so that they're compelling on a cash flow analysis basis, on an investment perspective, you know, it's a benefit to the economy that savers, for example, are able to collect decent levels of interest on their savings. And the data shows that people will spend interest income on their savings much more than they will spend, you know, notional stock returns, because stock market returns, as you know, they're very volatile, they're up and down. People see that as, you know, long-term and sort of unknowable, very difficult to plan. So they tend to spend cash flow much more than they will spend these kind of ups and downs in longer-term assets. So when interest rates are higher, it actually affords people a better ability to save, build compound interest, and also to spend in retirement. So if we're trying to support that aspect, you know, keeping rates higher is better and gives more incentive to people to save instead of just gamble. But on the other side, of course, we've got this very highly levered economy where higher interest rates are difficult in terms of they are going to constrain spending and probably economic growth for some time.
Now, on the opposite tack, how do you create your best future?
A discussion I put on the blog because Andrew Huberman had a guest, Ari Wallach, and who's a futurist. And I think sometimes we get, we're looking for optimistic ideas or protocols we can execute in our daily life to make ourselves better and to learn and to grow. And I just think that it's good to keep in mind that there are things that we can do on a tangible basis. We don't have to just be in casinos and be whipped around and, live and die by what the stock market did in a given day. We can actually try and plan what we want our life to look like. And indeed, when it comes to financial stability, it's very possible to build your financial strength over time and not be, as I say, whipped around by crazy asset markets. But it requires a certain amount of discipline and planning. So I recommend, though, that people listen to that interview, that discussion on creating your best future, about some actual protocols that you can do to envision where you want to be and to take steps towards that on a daily basis.
Yes, because I saw somewhere a survey found that 14% of Canadians think that betting on a lottery is their investment for the future. That's their pension plan. That's their retirement. And that's the same percentage of people who still think Elvis is alive. 14%.
Well, you know, if you look at, again, back to what the zero rate environment has engendered, it has engendered very reckless behaviors. And financially, it hasn't done us any favors because you know, as the baby boomers are 24 years older than they were in 2000, they own the bulk of the assets in the country. They're sitting on very overvalued real estate, which they are wanting to downsize. At some point here, they're hoping others will buy this off them. So because they tended to undersave in terms of liquid assets and retirement savings, because they were swept up in a couple, the two greatest financial bubbles of the last 100 years came in the last 24 years, right? The 2000 tech wreck and the 2008 financial crisis. And now we're right back at that level of risk again. And the point would be, it's difficult for people, if they have big losses, to make back that money. Many of them will want to return to work. Well, obviously, not everyone can go back to work in their 70s. That's pretty problematic for many. And I just think that their risk tolerance is much lower now than it was 24 years ago, and yet they're right back, you know, with this gambling mentality. And again, young people should learn from that you don't need to be as crazy and reckless in your approach, that there are a lot of, you know, regulated things you can do in terms of controlling your spending, actually saving month after month, you know, building up your net worth, keeping your debt low, all those good things.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. You can find us on X @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.